Welcome back. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us. Much is said about the current dysfunctional state of the American Congress, but today's hyperpolarization is nothing compared to the brawls and beatings, yes, I said brawls and beatings, that characterize the antebellum House and Senate chambers. In her new book, Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War, historian Joanne Freeman reveals that in the decades leading up to the Civil War, congressmen and their constituents grew to distrust each other to the point of violence. Drawing on vivid firsthand accounts, Professor Freeman explores how the first battles of the Civil War were fought inside the chambers of the United States Capitol. Joanne Freeman is a professor of history and American studies at Yale. Field of Blood is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and we're happy to welcome you to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So it's I will confess, I watched your Politics and Prose event, and I'm stealing this question. Tell me about the title. You were very excited to find the title of the book. It was just sitting there in your research.
It was, indeed. And I thank the history gods for giving me the title. It actually comes from a response to the most famous violent incident in Congress, which is the caning of the abolitionist Senator Charles Sumner. And he's violently caned in the Senate to the ground, and it's has a huge national uproar afterwards. And someone wrote a letter to Sumner, and this is a bad paraphrase, but what it basically said was, I knew that something was going to happen on that field of blood, the floor of Congress. Right? So I read that letter and thought, and now I have a title for my book.
There you go. Well, we're going to talk about Sumner later. Because everybody knows, well, everybody thinks they know that
yes.
story. But you write between 1830 and 1860, there were more than 70 violent incidents between
yes.
congressmen in the House and the Senate chambers. First of all, what kind of violence?
Okay, so violence, in one way or another, it's something physical. So it's someone shoving someone, punching someone, caning someone, pulling a knife or a gun on someone. Mass brawls, maybe once a session there'd be like a mass huge brawl. Guys getting mad and sort of flipping their desks because they'd lunge at each other. A couple dual challenges, but like honest to goodness, physical violence.
And also the chambers weren't sort of the august rooms that we think of now, right? They're a little gross.
Describe that. Definitely were. Well, they were, for one thing, especially the House. The House was really overcrowded and crammed full of people because we got a lot of states very quickly, and thus we got a lot of representatives very quickly, and the space wasn't really big enough. But these were rooms full of guys wearing probably too much clothing because in those days it's not like you had short sleeve shirts. So you had sweaty tobacco spitting guys in a space that already was, they took a climate report and determined that it was 30 degrees hotter inside than it was outside. So it was sort of sweaty and smelly and stinky and hot. There's a character in the book who he's a clerk in the House, and he says speaking out loud, reading things into the House is like putting your face in an oven and reading. So it was not a super pleasant space to work, I think.
So the environment alone, the physical environment, could lead to these kind of altercations.
Yes.
Why don't we know about this? Why isn't it in the newspapers of the time, the newspapers of record?
Right. That is the key question. Eventually, some of it gets there. But for a long time, it's not in the period's equivalent of the congressional record, and really not, for the most part, not a lot in the newspapers. And initially, when the period when the book starts, the 1830s, the Washington press community is really small. There's a handful of reporters. They sit in the House and the Senate. They take notes. They check what they've said with the people who were speaking. So it's kind of this nice sort of semi-contained universe, and there's no official record. So these are reporters for newspapers, and the newspapers have a political slant. So they want to please the people in their party in Congress. So for a whole bunch of reasons, including they're afraid of getting hit by a congressman if they displease them, they have many reasons not to want to make Congress look bad. So the record shows a lot of bravado, sort of, you know, macho guys, sort of, you know, being brave and making demands. But the actual dirty sort of rough edges of things don't appear for quite some time in the record. And this was my big question when I started the project was, now, wait a minute, I'm finding fight after fight after fight, mostly reading private letters and looking in diaries. How in the world has this story not been told? And that's precisely why if you look in the record and you don't know it's there, you're not going to see it. Once you know it's there,
you start to recognize code language.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting.
Exactly, exactly.
So as you mentioned, you said you started reading private diaries and letters. And there was one gentleman who just wrote everything down. I have a friend who says, you write it down because you expect somebody to read it someday. That's why you write everything down. Tell us who one of your main sources was.
Yeah, he ends up being, his name is Benjamin Brown French. And he's a totally obscure fellow, mm-hmm. so no one would really necessarily know who he is. He comes from a little town in New Hampshire. He comes to Washington to be a clerk in the House, not the clerk. But he's amazing because he has this amazing diary, an 11-volume diary. He's really good after an initial kind of rough start. He's constantly writing things in it. And it's not, you know, I read a lot of diaries in my time, and a lot of them are, you know, weather's bad today, had lunch with Mr. Smith. Benjamin Brown French writes everything down. I mean, what people are saying, what he's thinking, what he feels about, how the mood is changing, what he hears people whispering, and the fights as well. He writes a letter to his brother at one point, and he says, I can't believe this. I'm sitting here, and my job is to sit in the front of the room and watch what's happening. And they're having this big brawl, and my job is to take notes on it. Mm-hmm. So he's an amazing witness. And sure. He also has a newspaper column. Remarkably, he writes poetry about politics. So Benjamin Brown French ends up being kind of a guide slash witness mm-hmm. through the book. I was trying to figure out when I was writing the book, how do you tell a story of 70 violent incidents and have the people reading the book follow you through. And Benjamin Brown French was the answer to that, because you meet him at the beginning. And at the beginning of the book, he's this really nice guy and everybody mm. loves him, and people of both parties and Northerners and Southerners. And all he wants to do is appease the South, even on slavery, on everything, whatever he needs to do to keep the South happy so the Union stays together. And by the end of the book, he goes out to buy a gun in case he needs to shoot some Southerners. And to me, when I was reading about mm-hmm. him, I thought, if I can explain how he gets from point A to point B in the course of a book, that's a really different angle of getting at the coming of the Civil War.
We're talking to Joanne Freeman. The name of her book is Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War. All right. So one, of course, we have to talk about this part of the whole issue is North versus South.
Yes.
About the expansion of the United States and having to deal with slavery in the states. Explain to folks a little bit about how that laid the groundwork, how that was sort of the fertilizer for all of these different violent incidents.
Right. And it very much, the North-South divide plays a role, because the Southerners, generally speaking, this is a big broad generalization that mm-hmm. some historian will be angry at me for making, but generally speaking, the Southerners were more likely to be armed. The Southerners were more likely to want to fight man to man. Congressmen actually divided their ranks into fighting men and non-combatants, and those were their terms, mm-hmm. their lingo, congressional lingo. So given that the Southerners knew that they were more likely to fight, they were armed, they were willing to duel, Northerners weren't comfortable with that kind of behavior.
Yeah, that was interesting to me, that Northerners were like, duels? I think not.
Yes, and they assumed their constituents would assume that too. For a while, you're yeah. right, you think about the Burr-Hamilton duel, and it's clearly not just a Southern thing, but by this point in time, it's becoming more of a Southern
interesting.
Thing. Interesting. So that gives the Southerners an advantage, which they use. They know that they can intimidate and silence and threaten and sometimes assault Northerners into being quiet or being subservient or whatever else. But they can get them out of the way when they need to get them out of the way. And so they bully Northerners when it's convenient for them to bully Northerners. And that's their word for it, actually, is bullying.
Did Northerners fight back?
Well, for a time, they didn't. So for a time, sometimes they looked to the rules, you know, like, excuse me, aren't there rules in this body? And yes, there were, but they tend not to be enforced when people thought it was a fair fight. Sometimes they would sort of gesture towards wanting to respond, but they were very unsure if they responded violently or angrily that their constituents would follow along with them. They thought that even someone like John Quincy Adams, who, you know, former president, goes back to the House after being president, and at one point he's outraged by something. And in his diary, he also has a wonderful diary, he says, you know, I thought about saying something, and then I thought to myself, it's going to cause a fight, and then my constituents will yell at me for being a troublemaker, and so I just stayed silent. So Northerners were, you know, I call it the Northern congressman's dilemma, mm-hmm. that they were constantly trying to figure out what to do. And a lot of them faced with that situation. Do I fight back? Do I face disapproval back home? Do I humiliate myself by speaking up and then not being able to fight back? They really were sort of cowed by the situation for a time.
So let's talk about Charles Sumner.
Charles
from
Sumner.
Massachusetts. I always joke that in every black neighborhood, there's a Sumner school or a Sumner Avenue. It's right up there with MLK. Because he was such a champion.
Yes.
He was such an abolitionist and such a vocal one.
He was
a Northerner who was not afraid
to
speak his mind in very plain terms and use language that created a great affront to some of his Southern colleagues.
Indeed.
So the story of Charles Sumner being caned in the chamber, what led to it?
Okay, so he, shortly before the speech that ultimately led to the caning, I found a letter of his in which he says, you know, I need to get at the Southerners. Like, I need to sort of get in there and make some unrest among them. And right now we're talking about Kansas, so Kansas it will be. And so he gets up and gives this really aggressive, at points nasty, insulting, powerful speech about Kansas.
Profane for the time.
Yeah, for the time, yeah. About Kansas and slavery and barbaric Southerners. And I mean, he lets it rip. He's not a fighting man. He's definitely a non-combatant. And some Southerners, and in particular one named Preston Brooks from South Carolina, who's in the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. he's offended for the South. He's offended for South Carolina. Sumner insults a kinsman of his from South Carolina. So Brooks decides he needs to redeem the name of all of those things. So he comes into the Senate with his cane, confronts Sumner, who's sitting at his desk, actually, I think, franking copies of his speech to send out mm-hmm. to people, and says, you've insulted me, you've insulted my people, and you essentially have to pay for that, and begins to really violently cane him.
I remember in one account I read for some other project I was working on, and it described that Sumner may even have pulled the desk off the floor. He was holding onto it so tight.
Well,
is that
desk,
hyperbole, or is that?
No, the desk was bolted to the floor, mm-hmm. and he couldn't get out of it fast enough, pull his chair out fast enough. So in his effort to get away, he literally did pull the desk out of the floor that it was bolted to.
So were people ever reprimanded for this kind of behavior, you would think?
Yeah.
No?
No. Well, some people occasionally were reprimanded. Mm-hmm. Within Congress itself, few people were punished. And here's an example of why. I think my most frequent fighter is a fellow from Virginia named Henry Wise. And he's constantly, like, rolling up his sleeves and threatening people. He even threatens John Quincy Adams. He's trouble. And he ends up being governor of Virginia, so it's not like he's a, you know, back alley brawler, right. But he's a guy. So at one point, someone says to him, "You should be ashamed of yourself. You know, we should throw you out of this body for that kind of behavior." And Y says, "Do it, because you know what? I'm going to get reelected and put right back here because they put me here to do this." And what's striking is this is an age when congressmen, unlike now, it's not like a lifelong career. You're there for one term, possibly two, and then you're out.
And you go back home, yeah.
He's reelected six times.
Wow.
So he's right.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. That's echoes of today in many ways.
Yeah. People wanting their members of Congress to fight for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of this was also part of the lead up to the Civil War. Can you draw the line between what was happening in Congress to Civil War?
So it's not a direct line, so I can't say, which is why it's like the road to Civil War, sure. Not the cause of the Civil War. But certainly what Congress does, and this is not surprising, I'm sure, to anyone, it's a representative institution. So it reflects as well as shapes mm-hmm. public opinion. So what you see when you're looking at Congress, and this is part of what got me interested in the first place, I thought, well, what happens when you throw Northerners and Southerners in a room together at this period in time and then ask them to talk about slavery? How does that work out? And clearly it didn't work out really well. Mm-hmm. But over time, Northerners and Southerners begin to distrust each other more and more. They become more and more, at this point also the telegraph comes along. So the press is now spreading a lot of this rhetoric in Congress further and further, faster and faster. So as the slavery crisis begins to peak, people are getting a much closer look at what's going on in Congress. Congressmen are beginning to feel more humiliated at what's going on when they're insulted, that they feel that they need to fight back. Mm-hmm. So things really begin to rise in Congress, and the mood on the floor represents some of what's going on in the nation, because congressmen wouldn't be doing what they were doing if they didn't think that their constituents supported them. And then in time, the sort of final, I don't want to say nail in the coffin, but I can't think of anything else to say, is that when the Republican Party comes to Congress, and it's a Northern party and it's an anti-slavery party, and they come to Congress to fight, and they say that. So they campaigned saying, we will fight the slave power. And in Congress, they mean that in a literal kind of a way that people haven't really realized before. So these people come to Congress and they say, bring it, because we're a different kind of Northerner. And suddenly you really see a spike in the violence, because they stay true to their word and they fight back. And so then what you end up with in the end is, particularly in the House, congressmen are all armed. Northerners are afraid of what Southerners might say or do. Southerners are afraid of what Northerners might say or do. And they're kind of in this standoff of distrust, so that there's not really a lot of communication going on. There's certainly not a lot getting done. There are a lot of people who really want things to be better. But you know, over the course of the book, you watch Americans like Benjamin Brown French, mm-hmm. learn to distrust and then ultimately be willing to turn on each other.
Which brings us to today. Senator Ben Sasse was asked, have you seen this? Senator Ben Sasse was asked by the New York Times Book Review about what he's reading. And one of the questions is, what books do you think most accurately depict Washington? He said, I'm a fan of Joanne Freeman, but I hope that her new book, The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War, doesn't end up feeling like an accurate depiction of present day Washington.
I hope that, too.
Do you see parallels at all?
Well, sure. I mean, there are patterns that feel parallel, right? So extreme polarization, distrust in national institutions, worries about free speech and how that might explode into something dangerous, conspiracy theories and the press sort of feeding the frenzy. There are a lot of ways in which the mood and the tempo and the nature of what's happening now is familiar from the 1850s and other fraught moments like that in American history. So certainly when I was writing the book, particularly when I was finishing it, and I sometimes would have some cable news program on while I was editing, I would be writing. And for example, at one point I was thinking, you know, how can I get in the brain of these Northerners who are rooting for their congressman to fight? I don't understand. And I don't even remember what was on TV, but I looked up and literally said to the TV, well, fight! And I thought, okay, there, thank you very much, current day Congress, for...
And we are there.
Yeah.
The name of the book is The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War. It's written by Joanne Freeman. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us. The other good part of the book is a great bibliography.
Oh, yeah.
You have a really killer bibliography in here. So
I was thrilled they let me put the whole bibliography in there.
Yeah, history nerds, you'll love this. Joanne, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back with the story behind the mystery font that's taking over New York City. This is All With It on WNYC. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Whether you're walking down Broadway or Canal Street or you live in Brooklyn or Queens or the Bronx, you've probably seen the font that is slowly taking over New York. It's called Shock, and it's featured on signs for bagel shops, beauty salons, sushi restaurants, laundromats, all over the five boroughs. Rumsey Taylor, the eagle-eyed art director for the New York Times, who spotted this font all over the city, finally decided to figure out where the heck Shock came from and how it began to spread. Aiding him in this quest and quoted in the resulting article published in the New York Times was Stephen Heller, the co-chairman of the MFA program at the School of Visual Arts. Rumsey and Stephen, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Rumsey, I'm going to ask you to describe the font.
Sure. I think historically it's described as a script typeface, but even with that classification, it's really unique and idiosyncratic. So it looks like it was drawn with a brush. It has very thick strokes. It's not a classic script because the letters don't connect together, but it's a hugely bold typeface. It looks organic, like it was drawn by a human being, so you can spot it from across the street.
When did you first notice that this was everywhere?
For me, this was something of a frequency illusion at first. Well, I should backtrack a little bit. So I've studied as a graphic designer. I went to grad school, so I knew its history a little bit. I knew the designer. I knew where it comes from. I knew that it's from the 1950s. So by the time I spotted it out in the open, I knew a little bit about it. But when I moved to New York City, I started seeing it all over the place, and I didn't know if this was unique to the city or something in my imagination. And when I started working on this article, I went through Google Street View and tried to earmark as many places as I could find. And lo and behold, it's everywhere. So I found something over 50 or 60 locations, and I'm sure that's nowhere near comprehensive.
So the article mentions that the Shock stands out for its irregularity. Steve, when you think about fonts in irregularity, what does that mean?
Well, when I think about irregularity, I think about idiosyncrasy. And this font has an idiosyncratic quality to it. It doesn't follow what a reading font would be. It's not a sans serif. It's not a serif. It's a brushstroke. So it has this non-traditional attitude. It's an attitudinal font. It's kind of like, I often describe typefaces as clothes. You put on certain garments, blouses, coats, whatever, and they evoke a certain sensibility. They project something about you, or at least about the store that you got it in. And that's what typefaces are. And this typeface is one of those very personal, impressionable, expressionist fonts.
What do you think this typeface, this font, is trying to say to us? If it was, I think you maybe in the article used the word voice. What is it trying to tell us?
I think for non-designers in New York City, my conclusion would be is that it says something generalized about East Asian culture, if only because that's the context for it in New York City. That's what it's used for, and it's used so consistently and has been used so consistently for so long that here, if you see it on top of a sushi restaurant, for example, it feels appropriate to that context. And I should add that Shock is not used exactly in that same way in other cities, specifically in Europe, but in America, it seems to be the case.
Well, its origin is in Europe, correct?
That's right.
Tell folks where it came from and when it started.
It originated in France in 1955. It was designed by a typographer named Roger Excoffon, and he specialized... He's done a number of different things, but he's most known, I think, for his script typefaces, and they're all different, and they're all pretty stark contrast to what was trendy at the time in the mid-century, which was like modernist design, the era of Helvetica, which is a little late for that. And all of his work really stuck out as a sore thumb, and I think there's a lot of designers that weren't so... kind to the work, perhaps? Hated is the word. And I think, I mean, it's endured over time, and I think that's a testament to its distinctiveness, let's say. But in Europe, generally, and one of the people I spoke with, Sandra Chameray, who's a French designer who wrote a monograph, or co-wrote a monograph on Excoffon's work, stipulates that in Europe, they feel European, and they're used more broadly. Excoffon's work is used more broadly there than it is here. Here it's very, very, very specific.
We're speaking with Rumsey Taylor, who's the New York Art Director, and Stephen Heller, co-chairman of the School of Visual Arts MFA program. We're talking about the mystery font that took over New York. It's the piece that Rumsey wrote. So you said it was hated?
Hated is a mild word for it. there was... Typefaces have fashion qualities. Mm-hmm. And one of the aspects of a typeface is novelty. And the novelty expresses something about either the time, the place, or the thing that it's representing. There were, in the 30s, things called perfume fonts. Why? Because they advertise perfume. So every type has a personality. And Excoffon's types were very bold. As Rumsey says, they were very... shocking, as the name of, no pun intended. And he also did a typeface called Mistral, which was a script typeface that you find almost everywhere in Paris, mostly on dry cleaning stores.
And it's very frequent here.
And it's frequent
well.
Here.
But well, now I'm going to go look that up.
There are certain typefaces that look like they just got put into a template book. Mm-hmm. And in the case of sign painting, it's one of those typefaces that a sign painter who isn't necessarily trained as a typographer will use because it explodes, because mm-hmm. it has bold qualities, because it makes the sun shine. Whatever the reason is, they use it without thinking. And then when you introduce a designer into the mix, they start using it either differently or don't use it at all. And switch to other typefaces.
So now, how did Shock make it from Europe to the U.S.?
That's really difficult to determine. But what I've discovered, or my speculation rather, would be that Shock comes from a time where type was produced in hot metal and is used in letterpress machines, and it's evolved with the industry of how type is used to produce pieces of graphic design. So it was used for photo typesetting after that, and then the digital era, digital typesetting. So I think it's sort of been a standby, let's say, along with dozens, if not hundreds, of other typefaces over the course of the past 60 years. My guess would be that chalk is so distinctive that over time it's been reused because people just notice it, that it has a lot of potency. If you're...
It telegraphs something right away for something, people, right? Some sort of shorthand?
For sure. Even if it doesn't telegraph something specific to you, I think it stands out. There's something historically, permanently distinctive about it. So if you open a brand new restaurant today and you need to come up with a storefront from it and you're looking through a catalog of typefaces, I think there's something about it that will jump out at you. So I think like that quality and that typeface is the reason for its proliferation.
But it's also an interesting typeface, and we've been talking about this. There's type for the masses and type for the classes. The classes is when you go to a Jean Georges restaurant, you're not going to find Chalk.
Right.
It's just not going to be there. When you go to a supermarket and you look at something that is an artisanal product, you're not going to find Chalk. You're going to find Chalk for mass market foods or something other that appeals to a larger group of people.
That's true. There's something very inherently informal about its appearance.
And also, I think, this is just my observation, what do I know? There's a sense of a human being did it.
That's right.
Right? In this world of, we know everything is mass marketed and machines and robots, that brushstroke, we all know it's been reproduced, but somehow you have this feeling like, maybe somebody painted that on that. Is there that human element? Is that part of it?
Absolutely. And just recently, I got a piece of junk mail from Spectrum Cable or something like that. And it's a letter addressed to me, and it's written in a font that looks like handwriting, like Mistral, for example. And I look at it for a nanosecond before I realize it's not a font. And I put it in the trash. And I'm fooled by this piece of design because it emulates human correspondence. And I think Chalk and Mistral and other typefaces of that ilk have that quality where there's something informal, organic, humane about it.
Conversely, I got, when I started applying for Medicare, I got an email from the Social Security Department, and it was signed in Mistral. And I thought, this got to be fake. You know, why would a government agency use a typeface like this? So I called them, and somebody answered right away.
Do you know who I am?
Well, somebody answered right away, and I said, is this really the Social Security office? And they had all the information on the computer, so he convinced me he was for real. And I said, you know, your emails don't give off the sense of legitimacy because of the typeface. He said, yeah, we've had a lot of complaints about it.
We're speaking with Stephen Heller, who is co-chairman of the School of Visual Arts MFA program, and Rumsey Taylor, who wrote the article, The Mystery Font That Took Over New York. He is as well the New York Times art director. What has been the response to this? We know Times readers have responses.
Well, the response has been overwhelmingly good, I think. My guess as to why that is that it's not a pretentious piece of graphic design. It's something that anybody has access to who is free to have an opinion about. And as I state in the piece, that you can just walk outside and within 5 minutes we can go find this right now. It's everywhere. It's a part of New York culture. And I think that there are a lot of people who may have read this who have seen it before and like, now I know what it's called. Now I know where it's from.
And I would add that Rumsey did a great job, first of all. Second of all, he got terrific play. I was an art director at the Times as well and wrote design stories. But, you know, they always kind of shoved it under the carpet because they didn't think the readership would be all that interested in it. And the fact is, we live with design every day and we live with type more and more and more. It's not going away as vinyl records were supposed to go away. It's not going away as books were supposed to go away. We're always going to have it. Unless we get some chip in our head that just translates things into digits.
And one other thing I would say is that this, in as much as we're sitting here talking about typography and type history, this is a story about New York City. This is how a piece of design has become assimilated into New York culture. And as I said earlier, used in a very specific way.
Now you said assimilated. Is it ingrained? Or will this go away? In 10 years, will people think like, oh, remember Chalk?
It's hard to say. So
has it happened before?
Has it gone away before?
Has a certain sort of font or typography of a city been ubiquitous and then disappears.
In other cities, yes, like Gill Sands in London, or in the 30s in New York, Broadway. And it still is the Art Deco typeface. So you see it on building scaffolds where they're doing renovation of old pre-war buildings. And these things do stick around for a long time. Or they have their ups and downs and go in and out of fashion.
In my research, we spoke with a few sign makers, and the story isn't really about this, but I learned that in the sign making industry, there's something like an old school sign maker in New York City, and the technology that they may use might be outmoded, might not be the same thing that, like, if the sign maker is making like the sign in the front of this building, for example, might be a new one. But like this is a piece about vinyl siding and fabric signage in stores throughout Brooklyn, for example. And the way those things have been manufactured hasn't really changed for decades, and they still produce them. So I think there's something about the technology that is also has also resulted in why chalk is still prevalent.
Is there a font either of you think you'd like to see more of or less of in New York?
I'm sure Stephen has opinions.
Well, I have opinions, but they're always wrong.
They're your own. There's no wrong.
No, I mean, what I would like to see is more consistency. I mean, the term I used in Rumsey's article was chaos as opposed to cacophony. And I think when you go out into the boroughs, there's a lot more chaos. Or if you go on to the major shopping streets, there's a lot of chaos. Mm-hmm. A lot of it now is chaotic because it's just one brand after another. And these brands have been done with a lot of design research involved. So they've become kind of plastic. The kind of unique quality of type has been lost in Manhattan, just as many of the unique stores in New York have been lost. I would like to see more of an imagination being brought to bear in New York signage, and less of this chaotic quality, because the chaotic quality is underscored by just bad type.
That's true. The chaos doesn't bother me as much, because I think in some ways the typographic chaos, let's say, is emblematic of the city's cultural or anthropological diversity. So, like, even if the type was all consistent and well considered, that diversity would still be there. And I like the idea that graphic design echoes that aspect of the city. But to go back to your question, I would love to see, and we only touched on this a little bit when we were conversing for this article, Stephen, but I would love to see more handmade stuff, more hand-painted signing, because that era is long gone, and it was beautiful. I mean, this is before I was born, but I can't imagine walking through the city and seeing the storefront for a grocery, and everything had been drawn by hand the day before to advertise what's on sale. That sounds amazing to me.
And in Europe, this is the tradition. You go to certain cities or towns in the United States, and that's more of a tradition as well, where people learn to make signs to offset their salaries doing something else, or to actually make cottage industry out of it. In New York, it's become much more industrialized. And the sign makers, you know, they know their craft, but they don't necessarily have the aesthetic chops.
Isn't that what those little chalkboards kind of do?
Kind of, yes. But I think sometimes the practitioner of that chalkboard isn't as skilled as a sign painter might have been in the 1960s.
Oh, there's a guy on 9th Avenue and 20th Street. He's good.
we'll have to check that out.
Maybe that's your next article. The name of the article is The Mystery Font That Took Over New York. Thank you, Rumsey Taylor and Stephen Heller. We appreciate you stopping by.
Thanks so much.
It's great.
When we come back, we'll talk to journalist Emma Whitford about a movement getting traction in New York City and state to give rights to sex workers. More after a quick break. This is All of It. Yeah. You are listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us. 1 year ago, a 38-year-old woman, Yang Song, fell to her death from an apartment window during a police raid. Yang Song was a sex worker, and her death and the police raid, which some activists blame for her death, have become a rallying cry for sex worker rights, a movement that's gaining traction in New York. Journalist Emma Whitford has been following Yang Song's case for the past year, and she joins me now in studio. Thanks for coming by, Emma.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about Yang Song's life, how she came to be in Queens, and how she ended up in the sex trade?
Yeah, sure. So Yang Song, and also you'll hear her name in the press, said Song Yang. That's the Chinese mm-hmm. name ordering, so you'll hear it both ways. But she moved to New York in 2013 with her husband. Before that, she had been living in on the island of Saipan, which is off the coast of China. And there she had been working with her husband. They had two Vietnamese restaurants. There was actually a natural disaster that impacted tourism in the area, so she decided to move to the U.S. She came here with dreams of working hard, supporting her family, both her husband, who's older than her, and frail.
Significantly.
And significantly
was,
older.
Was it an arranged marriage, a convenient marriage?
I think that they met. I'm actually not sure how they met, mm-hmm. but my understanding is that, you know, they were in love, and also, but it did create some tension with her family mm-hmm. Because he was so much older. But so she, you know, had dreams of opening her own salon. Eventually, starting out with a temporary green card, she worked in a restaurant for a while and then ended up working in the massage business as a sex worker. And, you know, this is just some broader context about massage parlors. You know, for immigrant women who are coming to New York City, maybe without, don't speak fluent English, you know, Yang Song had a green card, but some come undocumented. And there are sort of informal networks of communication when you're trying to find work. And the thing about working in a massage parlor is it's not laborious work where you're working, say, in a restaurant on your feet all day long. Women I've talked to who worked in these establishments in the past will say, you know, I was looking in the Chinese newspaper and I saw a notice. Or, you know, I was in the Chinese grocery store and there was a notice posted. A lot of these women find jobs, too. They use a messaging app called WeChat, and they're sort of informal lines of communication. So, yeah, there are various ways that people start in that line of work. And, you know, the interesting thing about Song Yang is I think she, you know, it's not like work was easy for her. Right. Mm-hmm. But I think there's an important distinction to make right off the bat. You know, when police are talking about massage establishments, they're sort of lumped into this category of having to do with human trafficking. And the formal definition of human trafficking is something that involves force, fraud, and coercion. When you're talking to advocates for sex workers, they're very careful and clear to make a distinction that sex work is not necessarily trafficking. These are like two separate categories. So I think this is not to say that working as a sex worker in a massage establishment is necessarily like an easy job. There are all sorts of like labor questions and issues that come up, like sort of in any working class job. But when we talk about Yang Song, we're not talking about trafficking.
Yeah. Now, had she had previous run-ins with the police?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the tragedies of this story. Again, context about the courts and law enforcement around massage establishments. In Queens, there's this special court called the Human Trafficking Diversion Court. And it was set up, I think, in the early aughts, or mm-hmm. sorry, the early teens. And the idea is, say you're arrested on a prostitution-related charge. In massage establishments, there's also this charge about unlicensed practice of a profession. So that's basically operating a massage parlor without a proper business license. So if you're arrested on one of those charges, you'll go to this special court. And the idea is that rather than serving time or as an alternative to incarceration, you get diverted to a diversion program where you do things like counseling. Sometimes there's like healthcare, social work, all sorts of things. Just about, I think, a little over a month before this raid, when Yang Song fell to her death, she had been arrested on the same charge previously. And the real tragedy is she was almost finished with her mandated service. Mm-hmm. I think she had five mandated sessions. She had done four of them. the last one was coming up, and then this raid happened, and she either jumped or fell from the window, you know, acknowledging because in part because police were knocking on the door. So, you know, I think advocates will tell you that, you know, diversion programs are a great thing. But they'll also say that just based on the job opportunities that exist and the fact that people need to earn money, it's not uncommon to, you know, go back to working in the massage parlor. And so it's not like a 100% problem solving thing.
Now, you spoke to her family.
Yes.
How did they describe her and her life here in New York? Did they know the kind of work that she was doing? Did they know that she was getting involved with selling herself for sex?
Yeah. So this is something sort of interesting. I think initially what she said was she was working in a massage parlor, like doing foot massage. The interesting thing is that as soon as she passed, her brother and her mother rushed to New York to find out what had happened, and immediately found a community here among some community leaders in Flushing, and also some sex worker rights advocates who immediately kind of wanted to rush to their assistance. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to another community leader in Flushing who talked about sort of the dynamics about being a sex worker in the Chinese community in Flushing. And I think it's not something that's always easy to be open about, to speak about. I think there is a lot of shame and stigma. But over the course of the year, I often heard, you know, Yang Song's brother speak publicly about how she was a worker and she deserved the respect of any worker. Just this past Sunday at the one-year memorial, he was like, you know, I came to New York. I've always known what the Statue of Liberty is. It, you know, it waves to the city. And New York is this place of liberty. And then he had this idea of how the police are supposed to be in New York and that their job is to protect. And he was like, well, when it came to my sister, they didn't protect her. Not only were there these raids, but there's a sort of backstory. Not only was she arrested in the past, but she did report to the police. This eventually came out in the Queens DA's report that she had been assaulted on the job once. She had a client, and that client presented himself to her allegedly as an NYPD officer. If you talk to public defenders, the Legal Aid Society, they'll tell you it's not uncommon for their clients to tell stories of, you know, being harassed on the job. Whether or not that's actually a cop is sort of can be unknown. But Yang Song did go to the police, mm-hmm. and nothing came of that investigation. So I think her brother's like, well, you know, she went to the police, they didn't help her, and then there were these raids, and now she's died. So.
Was her death investigated by the NYPD?
It was. So whenever there is a death that occurs in the midst of a NYPD operation, they open a report. And this is something I think it's important to say that, so the investigation has been closed, and the Queens DA's office found no wrongdoing in Yang Song's death. That was never a satisfactory answer to her family. I think her family had a very challenging, heartbreaking year here, you know, financially, trying to stay, to find a place to stay in a community here, but also, you know, just being immigrants and not speaking fluent English, trying to communicate with the NYPD for a whole year. It was really challenging. But the conclusive findings of the report were that Yang Song jumped or fell in the midst of a police operation, but nothing that the police did was outside of their protocol. I think that's still a rallying cry for advocates.
I was going to say, yeah, that's part of the story. By the way, we're speaking with Emily Whitford. She's written
Emma.
Emma, sorry, Emma.
That's okay.
Sorry, Emma. Emma Whitford, it says it right there. The death of Yang Song is the story that she has written and she's been reporting on for the past year. That's part of this issue, that the advocates are saying that these raids like these are leading to situations that could, like Yang Song's.
Mm-hmm.
Why have they focused on that specifically?
Well, I think that I was sort of alluding to this earlier, but there are a lot of intersecting issues here, right, that we've been talking about a lot. New York being a so-called sanctuary city, you know, we're thinking about immigrant rights. Even just last year, the NYPD had a press conference with the First Lady, Shirley McCray, in February, saying, we recognize that, you know, there are very, very, very many vulnerable immigrant women in this city. They may be nervous about going to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So trying to take measures to make it easier for people to comfortably come to the police. So they actually pledged to make fewer arrests. Prostitution arrests happen in a lot of different ways. There are massage establishment raids. There can also be street arrests. There can be undercover sting operations, all sorts of things. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, by and large, arrests are down since the beginning of last year, after this initiative went into place. I think what advocates will tell you is that, you know, they're as long as they are still continuing, there's going to be a lot of fear. Like something like Yang Song's death, I talked to an organizer with the nonprofit Womankind, which works with survivors of trafficking. And one of the things she said is she remembers after Yang Song's death last year, there's, you know, word travels through the community and there's like a lot of anxiety. So I think what organizations like Womankind would like to do is like replace the NYPD engagement with alternatives like how can we help massage establishment workers, sex workers get access to assistance and help without that intermediary of the NYPD,
without there having to get arrest, without
right
their...
So Womankind does take referrals, you know, through the network of friends and family and things like that, and things they're working on are like ESL classes so people can learn English, or there's like a nascent movement to make it easier to get your official massage license to open a legal establishment that would help people.
What kind of changes to New York law could be made to help protect sex workers?
So yeah, and there's actually, this is quite interesting. I wrote a story for Splinter over the summer when Julia Salazar was running for the state Senate. She won her race. She's going to be representing Bushwick and part of North Brooklyn, where there are actually not so many massage establishment raids, but street arrests. So there's this charge called loitering for the purposes of prostitution, which advocates will tell you is so vague and sort of has given police officers the opportunity, if you know you're walking down the street and you're maybe wearing a short skirt or something like that. Mm-hmm. This is a law that had an outside impact on trans Latinx workers or trans Latinx New Yorkers who might not even be engaging in sex work, but there's like an assumption. So there is a new law. Senator Brad Hoyleman of Manhattan introduced it in the Senate, and it would just abolish that loitering statute. Mm. And Julia Salazar was really vocal in her campaign in support of that. Again, it would impact her constituents. And the interest, I think another important thing to say is that sex workers have been involved in advocating for their rights for a long time. Like, there's nothing new about this.
What is new then?
So I think what is new is just saying we're going to have a explicit platform of sex worker rights. And that's, it's nascent, but like I went to this sort of amazing event over the summer, a fundraiser for Julia Salazar that was organized entirely by sex workers. And it was, you know, at a bar in Bushwick, and the room was full. And there were these older women, members of the community in the room, who were just sort of in awe. They were like, I never thought I would be in a room full of 100 sex workers talking about politics. And I also participated or shadowed a canvassing event for Julia Salazar led by sex workers. And organizers don't think something like that has happened before.
What did you observe on that? How do people react?
It was interesting. I mean, door knocking is always tricky. Yeah. A lot of times people like aren't home or busy. But in the instances where people talked about sex work explicitly, I personally didn't witness any strong animosity. It was a sort of joint platform. They were talking about Julia Salazar as well as also Cynthia Nixon's campaign and all sorts of things. But definitely some participants were going into it like a little bit nervous and like what's going to happen. But they did a lot of training and they didn't seem to have any issues there.
Since you've been covering this story, and this is a little bit of asking you to speculate, but what do you predict will happen, or what change could happen as the result of the tragic death of this young woman?
Well, something really interesting. There's a collective of migrant massage workers actually in Canada and Toronto that's existed since 2014. A year ago, I was writing a story about this, and we couldn't find any similar groups specifically in New York. Now, 1 year after Yang Song's death, there's this brand new group. They're called, it's very nascent, but the name is Red Canary Song. And the organizers are both former sex workers, familiar with and are working, and also bilingual, and working to sort of get together a group of migrant sex workers to do basic things like that don't require law change, like know your rights trainings for when you interact with the police.
Emma Whitford, the name of the article is The Death of Yang Song. Thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your reporting. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
That is our show, everybody. Thanks for listening to All of It. Join us tomorrow and every day at noon on WNYC. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsap, Andres O'Hara, Joseph Caprileone, and Ursula Summer. Matt Miranda is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow All of It on Instagram and Twitter at All of It WNYC. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.